Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, the High Court in Massachusetts rules the state must allow gay couples to wed.
We now have a state Supreme Court saying in no uncertain terms that it works a deep and scarring hardship on same-sex families to deny them the benefit of a civil consecration of their marriage.
But opponents say the fight is not over.
Suppose a legislature doesn't do that. What can the Supreme Court do? They can't do very much. They can't take out their guns and shoot them.
Also, Jonestown remembered.
A British poll indicates President Bush isn't that unpopular with the British public, after all.
And they might be giants. They're definitely children's authors.
These stories coming up here and now.
The news is first.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In a ruling that's been anticipated around the country and the world, the Massachusetts Supreme Court has concluded that the state cannot legally prevent gay couples from getting married. The court stopped short of granting licenses, but the ruling is in favor of 7 gay couples who had sued the state after they were denied marriage licenses. Joining us on the line is constitutional scholar Lawrence Tribe of Harvard's Law School. And Professor Tribe, what does this ruling mean? When can gay couples get married in Massachusetts?
As I read the ruling, because the court stayed its judgment for 180 days, that means that gay couples can get married 180 days from now. They don't have to wait for permission from the state legislature, although the state legislature has been invited to work out the details during that interim 180-day period.
Is there anything that the state can do in the next 180 days to stop the Supreme Court decision?
No. The only way to stop this decision would be for the state to amend its constitution to eliminate the rather basic principle that was affirmed in this case, that the dignity and equality of all individuals means that marriage cannot be limited to opposite-sex couples. That would take an amendment to the state constitution, and that would take several years to effectuate. And in the interim, same-sex couples can get married in Massachusetts. They have a fundamental right to do that. And their basic self-respect and dignity has been affirmed by this decision, quite apart from the technicality of whether they have a license. We now have a state Supreme Court saying in no uncertain terms that it works a deep and scarring hardship, as the court put it, on same-sex families and their children to deny them the benefit of a civil consecration of their marriage. And it seems to me that statement in itself is a ringing affirmation of human equality.
Well, when you say the state has to work out the details in 180 days, what are some of the ways they might work them out? Could they possibly, for instance, offer a Vermont-style civil union?
No. Certainly some people in the state legislature are going to try to create second-class marriage licenses, but this opinion couldn't be clearer that anything that symbolically shove same-sex couples into the shadows or into some kind of closet would be unconstitutional. Of course, the marriage license could specify the gender of the couples so that one could tell by looking at the license if it was a same-sex marriage or an opposite-sex marriage. That's not a problem. But the only task for the legislature is a very mechanical, ministerial one. It's like changing he to he or she.
Now, you mentioned the possibility of a constitutional amendment, and there is a move to draft and pass a constitutional amendment asserting that a marriage can only be between a man and a woman. As you said, that might take 2 years. What happens if the state legislature does draft that amendment and it does pass? What happens to those marriages that might occur after 180 days?
Well, there are two points to be made. First of all, any such amendment to the state constitution would itself be subject to challenge under the federal constitution on the ground that it violates the equal protection of the laws. If, on the other hand, such an amendment were not struck down, then there would be a dilemma for the state. Either the couples who had been married in the interim would be grandfathered in, or there could actually be an attempt by the state retroactively to roll back the clock and effectively negate these marriages.
How about these marriages as far as how they're recognized nationwide? The Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which was passed in 1996, says no state has to recognize another state's gay marriage.
That's right. But as soon as a couple married in Massachusetts, a couple of the same sex married in Massachusetts, is denied equal treatment by another state under the Defense of Marriage Act, they will have a strong basis for challenging that discrimination.
Professor Tribe, we just have a few seconds left. I just want to ask your personal response to this. Are you surprised at the ruling, and how important is it?
I think it's monumentally important. I really was not prepared to gamble either way as to what the outcome would be. I was obviously hopeful that the court would have the courage of its egalitarian convictions, even though it's quite a conservative court.
Professor Tribe, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Professor Lawrence Tribe of Harvard Law School. We now turn to Brian Kamenker, president of the Massachusetts-based Parents' Rights Coalition and opponent of same-sex marriage. Brian, your response to the court ruling.
It's, You know, Robin, it's complete lunacy. I mean, we've really lost control of our judiciary system when a court can come up with something as bizarre as that, that the state basically must force two men to be allowed to be married. I guess we sort of knew that was going to happen some years back when with the parade case, the South Boston parade case, when they said that parades had to be forced to allow homosexual marchers. And that ruling was overturned 9-0 by the U.S. Supreme Court. So I think we have seen a radicalization of our court system in general, and the judicial court, Supreme Judicial Court in particular. This is beyond anybody's imagination that this would have happened.
Well, there are other rulings recently. The Canadian courts that ruled in favor of gay marriages, the U.S. Supreme Court protection of the privacy of gay couples in their bedroom, a 1993 Massachusetts law allowing two gay people to adopt the same child. What is your organization going to do, and why are you so adamant about fighting this apparent legal tide?
I think that the broad spectrum of people are incredibly against this. This is the reason that this is being done by activist courts is that by and large it could never get through state legislatures. You know, this is being done by I think a fairly fringe group of people, you know, with a political agenda that goes against common law, goes against natural law, and goes against the will of the people. You know, if we weren't doing it, 100 others would be doing it.
Well, according to Professor Tribe's interpretation of the ruling, these marriages, same-sex marriages, will take place in 180 days in Massachusetts. There's nothing the state can do to stop them. And even if the state proceeds with a move to pass a constitutional amendment that would, in effect, ban them, it would procedurally take years and would probably be challenged.
The Supreme Court gave the legislature 180 days to have marriage licenses for homosexuals presented. Suppose a legislature doesn't do that. What can the Supreme Court do? They can't do very much. They can't take out their guns and shoot them. And that is what I believe will happen, is that the legislature will not do it. And then there's a standoff. And I think that the legislature won't do it. And in fact, our organization is started a few months ago. We're going to stop it. The broad, you know, masses of people in this state are with us on this. Maybe not the media, maybe not, you know, the educators, maybe not Lawrence Tribe, but everybody else. So I think that's what's going to happen.
Well, Brian, thank you for your time now, and we will check back with you in 180 days.
Well, you can do that before then, too. I'm always glad to talk to you.
Brian Kamiker, president of the Parents' Rights Coalition. He spoke to us from Waltham, Massachusetts. We also spoke with Professor Lawrence Tribe, a supporter of today's Massachusetts Supreme Court decision demanding the state clear the way for same-sex marriages. For the full text of the decision, go to our website, here-now.org. Two 260 children died deep in the jungle. All told, more than 900 men, women, and children drank the Kool-Aid and died an excruciating, horrifying death. 25 years ago today, the world became aware of the mostly poor, largely African-American cult following of the charismatic Jim Jones, a white man from rural Indiana who founded the People's Temple in San Francisco and then took his followers to Guyana. Recordings exist of their final moments there, a murder-suicide Jones ordered his followers to take part in. A word of caution, what you're about to hear is as difficult to listen to now as it was 25 years ago.
Children, it's just something to put to the rest. Oh, God. Don't be this way. Stop this hysterics. This is not the way for people who are socialists and communists to die. We must die with some dignity.
Religion reporter Don Ladin first reported on the Jonestown tragedy for the San Francisco Chronicle. Don's on the line. I'm sure that sound still sends shivers to you as it does to me.
That's exactly what it just did, Robin.
Yeah.
I actually hadn't heard the tape for a while. I didn't even read the transcript, but
it
is horror. It's absolute horror. And what I think is important to remember and to realize is that that horror began with hope. People don't join these groups. Don't kill themselves for no reason. Originally, people joined People's Temple because of social idealism and political activism, with a spiritual bliss that they felt in worshiping there. But that just went down into this paranoid spiral as Jim Jones got crazier and crazier, more paranoid. The leader of a group like this projects both his spiritual enlightenment, his political dreams, and also his psychosis, his insanity, onto the congregation. So that's what happened with People's Temple.
And he was not only a charismatic religious leader, but he was a friend to the ACLU, a friend to the media, including your own paper, local politicians. He was invited to the White House during the Carter administration.
That's right.
And then, of course, as you said, something went terribly wrong. But still, mothers, I mean, there's other sound that some of us remember of him telling the mothers to keep their children quiet while they kill them.
Yes. Yes. I mean, what can be more horrible than the thought of mothers squirting poison down their babies' throats?
What did they fear? Congressman Leo Ryan of San Francisco had just traveled to the Jonestown, and he was taking away some defectors, and there was another horrendous scene of him being killed at the airport as he tried to fly away.
Mm-hmm.
Were they afraid of being found out?
I think there's a couple things that were going on. One, by that time, some people were there against their will. Their passports had been taken away. They had no choice but to do what they did. Other people, I think, did do it, in a sense, voluntarily. Jones was convinced and convinced his flock that the CIA was after him. The government was after him. They had practiced committing what they called revolutionary suicide. And that paranoia had spread. And I think a lot of the People's Temple members actually thought they were going to go off, you know, to the promised land, that Jones was the people's messiah. Mm-hmm. As hard as it is to understand this, I think it's some of that same fanaticism and fervor we see in suicide bombers today.
Well, I know that there's a cemetery in Oakland where 406 of the Jonestown victims lie under one headstone. Does this still resonate for people?
I hope it does, and it gets a lot more attention on these big anniversaries like the 10th and the 25th. But there are years. They gather, some of the survivors and family members gather every year, and sometimes there are only four or five people. You know, I think it's important for young people to know about this and remember that this can happen again, and that it did happen with Heaven's Gate, the UFO cult in Southern California, with Waco, David Koresh, you know. And I hate to say it, but I think it will happen again.
Well, Don, thank you.
Thank you.
Don Lattin first reported on the Jonestown tragedy for the San Francisco Chronicle 25 years ago today. His book is called Following Our Bliss, How the Religious Ideals of the 60s Shape Our Lives Today.
Just ahead, does a newly leaked memo prove long alleged links between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein?
And later in the program, from the rock group They Might Be Giants, lullabies.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Case closed. reads this week's cover of the conservative magazine been proven, according to the magazine's lead story, is the existence of links between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Now, that alleged relationship was, of course, one of the Bush administration's main justifications for going to war in Iraq. Stephen Hayes wrote the Weekly Standard piece based on a newly leaked document. He now joins us on the line. Welcome, Stephen.
Hey, good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us, Steve. The piece is based on what?
It's based on a memo that was written by the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Doug Feith, on October 27th to the Senate Intelligence Committee, which was looking at the Bush administration's claims of pre-war claims of links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda.
And this memo contained information from what intelligence sources?
From a wide variety of intelligence sources, from the CIA to the Defense Intelligence Agency to the NSA, the National Security Agency, which handles telephone intercepts, to the FBI, I mean, a wide range of domestic intelligence agencies, as well as foreign.
Some 50 excerpts from CIA and FBI and DIA and so on, intelligence sources here. Let me note one. Quote, reporting from a well-placed source disclosed that Osama bin Laden was receiving training on bomb-making from the Iraqi intelligence service's principal technical expert on making sophisticated explosives. Okay, Steve, there's a link. But throughout this memorandum, we are basing the information on well-placed sources, sensitive sources. Nothing is named. Nothing is a smoking gun, so far as I can tell. Do you disagree?
Well, yeah, I do disagree. First of all, I think, you know, some of the well-placed sources, I mean, some of this information comes firsthand from former senior Iraqi intelligence officials who were debriefed after they were captured after the war. So I think that's pretty good reporting. I mean, I have obviously no way of verifying that what they're saying is true independently, but I think that's, you know, that's pretty good sourcing. And I think when you get to a point where you have so many sources talking about these links, with some of them providing very specific details, including one guy who was close to Osama bin Laden in the mid-1990s, providing dates and times and flights and names of people he met with. I think that becomes, you know, that becomes hard to dispute.
Yeah, but is pretty good sourcing, as you call it, enough for a case closed, as the piece is called? Now, the great majority of the information in the memos is about alleged meetings between Iraqi intelligence and al-Qaeda. But couldn't even years of meetings indicate an interest in working together that never amounted to anything?
No, I believe that this memo shows conclusively that they certainly had a relationship, that it went well beyond just links, that they were working together. I mean, you have discussions in the memo about payments as late as March of 2002, if I'm not mistaken, of $100,000 from Iraqi intelligence to Ansar al-Islam, which is an al-Qaeda splinter group in northern Iraq. And when we said case closed, I think the people who came up with the headline, the idea was, we have heard now for months from skeptics that there were no links, there were no links whatsoever, and, you know, that was all fantasy from the Bush administration. I think it's interesting to note some of the same critics now sort of recalibrating their analyses and saying, okay, well, there might have been links, but we don't know how meaningful the links were. It looks like they were just trying to establish a relationship rather than executing one. I think we'll see more of this come out as we search intelligence files in Iraq, you know, over the next several months.
Steve, this is raw data, information from unnamed sources, unanalyzed by experts. And the Pentagon itself said Saturday, in the course of deploring the leak and saying it might be illegal, the Pentagon said, quote, news reports that the Defense Department recently confirmed new information with respect to contacts between al-Qaeda and Iraq are inaccurate. What do you make of that?
Well, I think they must not have been talking about my article to make that claim. I mean, they're knocking down claims that I didn't make. And I think if they were hinting that my article were inaccurate, I think it's important. You know, obviously, the Weekly Standard is a respectable publication. We basically just regurgitated excerpts of the memo that we got. You know, I think it's important if you're talking about inaccuracy, show us where it is.
Steve, W. Patrick Lang, former head of the Middle East section of the DIA, said yesterday that your article, quote, is a listing of a mass of unconfirmed reports, many of which themselves indicate that the two groups continued to try to establish some sort of relationship. If they had such a productive relationship, Patrick Lang asks, why did they have to keep trying?
Well, this is exactly the kind of mentality that I was describing earlier. I mean, I think it's interesting.
We're talking about Patrick Lang, a former head of the Middle East section of the DIA. Has he got an axe to grind? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying he has an axe to grind. And, you know, certainly he's a professional. He's entitled to his opinion. He has a lot more experience talking about these things than I do. That said, I think, you know, there are certain elements within U.S. intelligence agencies that have been committed to this mindset that bin Laden and Saddam would not cooperate because it's not in their interests to have done so.
People are skeptical of intelligence in certain quarters. Intelligence led us into the war in Iraq based on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and we haven't found any.
Yeah, I think it's fair. I actually think it's wise to be skeptical of intelligence as a general matter. I mean, intelligence is a murky thing to look at. You know, there are very rarely occasions where there is conclusive proof, as I believe there is in this memo.
Now, Steve, the CIA has asked for an inquiry into this leak, which is fairly routine when leaks like this happen. But do you have any legal concerns?
No. I mean, journalists, you know, as a journalist, I never would discuss my sources, never would reveal my sources. So I don't really have any concerns. But I think your questioning today is important because you spent a lot of time, obviously your questions were challenging my conclusions, which is fine, but you spent a lot of time talking about the substance of the report. I'm a little troubled by people who are focusing only on the potential investigation. For instance, the Washington Post spent very little time talking about the substance of the report and are now all of a sudden writing stories about an investigation into an alleged leak. It seems a little silly to me, and I'm glad you spent as much time as you did on the substance of it.
Stephen Hayes wrote the piece, Case Closed, in this week's edition of the Weekly Standard. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us on it.
You bet. Thank you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a journalist tells the story of a young man's suicide. That young man, her 12-year-old son.
And we talk with Marianne Pearl, the widow of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, rolling out the red carpet. A new poll shows that more than half of British residents welcome a visit by President Bush.
Anti-Americanism is a very small force in Britain. Although the war was unpopular, it doesn't mean that people are anti-American.
Also, Italians mourn the death of 19 of their countrymen killed in Iraq.
And add, they might be giants to the list of celebrities in the kids business.
We're big fans of picture books, so we were trying to think of what kind of music could accompany a picture book, and we kind of thought of lullabies.
What do you hear? These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. As you may have heard on Here and Now, there is a landmark ruling by the State Supreme Court of Massachusetts. The justices have ruled that same-sex couples cannot be banned from marrying under the state constitution. Fred Tice reports from Boston.
In its ruling, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court said today that the Massachusetts Constitution forbids the creation of second-class citizens. Writing for the court, Chief Justice Margaret Marshall says the state has failed to show any reason why two people of the same sex should be denied civil marriage. Marshall said the court is mindful that it is changing the history of marriage law. Marshall quoted the United States Supreme Court's decision this summer that struck down the nation's anti-sodomy laws. In that decision, the Supreme Court said, "Our obligation is to define the liberty of all, not to mandate our own moral code." The court is staying its decision for 180 days in order to give the legislature time to take appropriate action in light of today's decision.
That is reporter Fred Tice in Boston. Virginia jurors in the trial of the 18-year-old sniper suspect have heard what authorities call Lee Malvo's confession. The tape was recorded while Malvo was jailed last year. Meanwhile, in another courtroom, the prosecution continues to present witnesses in the penalty phase of John Muhammad's trial. Prosecutors are hoping to persuade jurors that the convicted sniper must be sentenced to death. The U.S. military continues to react forcefully to an upsurge in resistance activity in Iraq. American fighter jets attacked suspected insurgent positions today. U.S. military officials say insurgents had detonated a roadside bomb, wounding two soldiers in northern Iraq. The Pentagon says it has uncovered remains at the Laos site where Howard Dean's younger brother was believed to have been killed nearly 30 years ago. The remains were not officially identified but were found along with Charles Dean's personal items, according to the Democratic presidential candidate's campaign spokeswoman. Charles Dean was 24 years old in 1974 when he and a travel companion were detained by the communist Pathet Lao and held in a prison camp before being killed. On Wall Street, stocks are little changed at this hour. The Dow up a fraction of a point at 97.11, the NASDAQ up 3 points at 19.12, and the S&P 500 ahead slightly at 10.44. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Conventional wisdom at the moment would seem to be that President Bush and the United States are rather unpopular in Great Britain at the moment, because at the moment, 14,000 police are bracing for tens of thousands of protesters in London during the president's state visit there over the next 4 days. But a new British poll seems to show that looks can be deceiving. The majority of Britons are actually quite pro-American, according to the poll, and half those polled say they welcome the president's visit. Julian Borger writes for The Guardian newspaper, which conducted the poll. He joins us now on the line, and welcome, Julian.
Hello.
Julian, this sort of flies in the face of conventional wisdom, doesn't it?
It does. I think it's caused a certain amount of surprise in Britain. It's very interesting, the nuances that it shows in British public opinion. And one thing I think it shows beyond any doubt is that anti-Americanism is a very small force in Britain. Although the war was unpopular and George Bush is reasonably unpopular, people don't think much of him, it doesn't mean that people are anti-American. And that goes across the party divides. Overall, 62% described the U.S. as a force for good against 15% describing it as a force for evil. So there's a pretty decisive majority.
Julian, is there a divide between people's feelings about America and people's feelings about America's president?
Yeah, I think so. And really, to get at that divide, you'd have to look at another poll done for Newsweek in recent days, in which 62% found that Bush was not very intelligent, 53% insincere, 82% said he does not care much about the views of people in other countries, and so on and so on. On the other hand, if you look at the Guardian poll, a small majority, a plurality, welcomed the visit. Now, you know, this is speculative, but one way you could explain this is you can welcome the visit and not necessarily agree with President Bush's views. You may welcome the visit because it gives an opportunity to British people and British government to explain differences of opinion, and you may welcome the visit just because it would be rude not to.
Julian, opposition to the war, that seems to be shifting too. I think first of those immense crowds at the time of the war, 2 million people in the streets of London. And yet, support for the war seems to be going up a bit, right?
Yeah, it's interesting that there has been a rebound, and it's not just a question of do you continue to support the troops staying on there, which most Britons do on the view that they need to stay there to stabilize the country. But even on the question of whether the war was justified or unjustified, you're seeing a rebound with 47% saying it was justified against 41% unjustified, and that's a switch around from recent months. And again, it's hard to explain because obviously no weapons of mass destruction have been found. One possible explanation is that British TV viewers were being seen pictures from where the British troops are and Basra and the south, which has been relatively peaceful, where there have been examples of people's lives improving and of government services being restored to people, and people saying, well, thank God, and these are mainly Shia people in the south, of course, saying, thank God, you know, we had a terrible time under Saddam and there was torture and there were killings. So that might have had an influence.
How does this all affect Tony Blair's standing? He's had some pretty rough sledding with the public in recent months.
Yeah, he is a small rebound in his standing. He still remains an unpopular prime minister, with 52% saying they don't think he's doing a very good job. So he's still got some ways to go, but at least for Tony Blair, is moving in the right direction.
Julian Borger, Washington-based reporter with The Guardian newspaper. Thanks so much, Julian.
Thank you.
Il Signore sia con voi.
Nineteen Italians killed last Wednesday in Iraq were laid to rest early this morning in a state funeral at St. Paul's Basilica in Rome. The attack at Nasiriya produced the most casualties of any single attack against Italians since World War II, and thousands of their countrymen poured into the streets to mourn the dead. Joining us on the line from a studio in Italy is BBC correspondent David Willey. Hello, David.
Hello.
Well, paint the scene for us in Italy this morning.
Well, for the past, the previous 24 hours, there was thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps half a million people here in the centre of Rome giving their last tribute to the dead carabinieri and the soldier and the two civilians who died last week in southern Iraq and whose bodies lay in coffins in an enormous monument called the Italians call it the Altare della Patria, which means the altar of the nation. It's a place of military reminiscence and records, and it was very apt that these soldiers should receive their last tribute from the public here in the centre of Rome.
We understand that the families of the victims were at the funeral with the Italian president. It was televised live.
That's right. And it's a day of mourning here, national mourning. The authorities have asked Italians to display their national flag, the red, white and green Italian flag, which of course was draped on all the coffins. But many people along the route of the funeral hung out Italian flags. Young people you could see draping themselves in the flag. It's a big patriotic occasion, an occasion for Italians remembering who they are and the importance of their armed forces.
We understand that this reflects sort of a groundswell of pride in the role that they played in the war in Iraq, which is somewhat, or I'm wondering, is that somewhat ironic, you know, dovetailing against protests against the war elsewhere around the world?
Well, the Italian contingent, numbering about 2,500, went off to Iraq after the cessation of hostilities, or the so-called end of the war. But, of course, they found themselves in this no-man's land in a situation where everyone is a potential victim of terrorist attack, and that's exactly what happened. The Italians went to Iraq not to join coalition forces in fighting, but to carry out humanitarian work. The Italians were doing clearing landmines. They were helping to train Iraqi police, helping rebuild water pipes and things like that. And it came as a great shock to find that they, just like other humanitarian workers like the Red Cross or people from the United Nations, were also victims of terrorist attack.
I guess, we know that an Italian member of the U.S.-led coalition, Marco Calame, resigned over the weekend. He accused the American-led administration of inefficiency, said the provisional authority simply doesn't work. But I'm wondering, does it feel to you like a groundswell of pride in the Italian role in Iraq?
Enormous pride, enormous regret at the same time that Italians are involved in this international adventure, which no one knows quite how it's going to turn out in the end. Mr. Berlusconi, so far, has been very supportive of President Bush, but this is a very divided country. Just for today, a day of mourning, Italians have put these differences aside, but I have no doubt that in the days to come we're going to hear many dissenting voices and many calls to Mr. Berlusconi to bring Italian troops home, so that they don't suffer another misfortune like the one which occurred last week.
Well, David, thank you.
It was a pleasure to speak to you.
David Woolley, BBC correspondent from Rome.
Still to come, the rock group, They Might Be Giants, now want to rock your kids to sleep.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Well, movie star and former world-class bodybuilder Arnold Schwarzenegger became governor of California yesterday, calling himself an idealist without illusions. Governor Schwarzenegger got right to work. He confronts a budget deficit estimated at more than $24 billion. Joining us on the line is political reporter Ellen Cherchek from Sacramento. Welcome, Ellen.
Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you. Ellen, give us a laundry list of what this very dynamic governor plans to do almost right away.
Well, he's done a lot of things right away. The first thing he did after being sworn into office was to repeal the car tax. The tripling of the car tax that took effect during the Davis administration. He then immediately called a special session of the legislature. They're going to look at three issues, which include the state's fiscal crisis, which Schwarzenegger contributed to by repealing the car tax. They're going to look at repealing the bill that Governor Davis signed that allows illegal immigrants to get driver's licenses. And then they're also going to look at a jobs package, which will include workers' comp reform, something they already worked on for 3 years straight and had just passed a bill.
Well, you know, he's not showing a lot of respect for anything Governor Davis did, is he? He's called for a review of all regulations adopted, amended, or repealed during the former governor's administration.
That's right, and he also signed an executive order doing that yesterday. So, I mean, he wasted no time yesterday. He was sworn in, he went back to the office, and he started signing papers even before his first inauguration luncheon.
And Ellen, how's it going down with the overwhelmingly Democratic legislature?
Well, right now, most of them are trying to be cordial. There's not a lot of public naysaying. They talk about his charming personality, his ability to get things done, and they have agreed to come into special session today and to start working on these issues. And so we'll have to wait and see if they do any of these things that he has said that he wants them to do.
There has been a famously contentious relationship between the legislature and the governor, certainly in the past few years. Could this honeymoon go sour in the short term? Anybody commenting on that? Or?
I think the big question will be how Governor Schwarzenegger and Senate leader, Democratic leader John Burton interact, because nothing will get to the governor's desk without John Burton's approval. Although Schwarzenegger has vowed that if the legislature does not do what he wants, he will take all his issues to the people and to the ballot.
and a real sense of relief among Californians that the kind of craziness of the past couple of years has at least been now taken in tow by this enormously dynamic guy.
Oh, they've been totally taken in by his charm, by his movie star status, and by his phrase that he is the people's governor. And they said that the numbers I heard, there were 1,700 invited guests to his inauguration, and thousands turned up to wait outside the barricades. And one of the most, I'd say probably one of the highlights yesterday of the inauguration was when he was sworn in and then everyone clapped. And then from way back, you could hear, "Arnold, Arnold, Arnold, Arnold," as the crowds behind the barricades cheered for him, and it was almost like an echo going back, and he started laughing, the crowd started laughing. It was quite a moment.
Political reporter Ellen Cherchak joining us from Sacramento. Thanks a lot, Ellen.
You're welcome.
California, California, you're such a wonder that I think I'll stay. Big time rollers, part-time models.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Particle man, doing the things a particle can. What's he like? It's not important. Particle man.
They might be giants, are two guys who grew up together near Boston and then did something very few people ever pull off. They formed a band in New York, which not only survived, but to all appearances, their friendship did too. Their musical career includes a slew of rock albums now, spanning 20 years, as well as music for commercials and television shows, like the Grammy Award-winning theme to Malcolm in the Middle.
Yes, no, maybe. I don't know. Can you repeat the question? You're not the boss of me now. You're not the boss of me now. You're not the boss of me now. And you're not so big.
Well, now there's a They Might Be Giants book and accompanying music to put little kids to sleep. John Flansburgh on guitar and John Linnell on accordion are They Might Be Giants, and we welcome them now in the studio. Hi, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming in. Well, John Flansburgh, the children's book is Bed, Bed, Bed,
yes,
which pretty much sums up what it's all about, right?
Yeah, it was kind of a package deal. We did this children's album last year called No, and we wanted to kind of follow up on the success of that since a lot of people were really excited by that project. And we're big fans of picture books, so we were trying to think of like what kind of music could accompany a picture book, and we kind of thought of lullabies and that setup.
Yeah, the album No was a huge success. Actually,
yeah.
It was number one on the Billboard Children's Album chart.
Yeah, we weren't even aware that there was such a thing, but they got charts for everything in that magazine.
If there is going to be such a thing, you may as well be number
one.
Yeah,
well, that's a nice place to be.
Let's go right away to some of the music from the new album, which is called Bed, Bed, Bed. Happy doesn't have to have an ending.
Come on now, you got no happy, doesn't have to have an ending. Remember this before we part, you've got to sing out loud when the music starts. You've got to shake your tail when you hear this part.
Now, John Linnell, that's a rocking little number. Is that something to get a kid to sleep with?
Well, you know, I think generally we found that the songs are for listening to in the daylight hours,
yeah,
and the book is for reading at bedtime.
Right, right.
Once the kids are familiar with the songs, then they, you know, the the picture book adds a new dimension.
Right.
Now, are either you guys raising children at this point
yes,
to have moved
yes.
into the? Yeah, you
I
are.
Have,
John.
I have a son,
John Linnell.
Yeah, I have a son in kindergarten who we you know test marketed the book with, and he. I mean, the great thing is, you know, I suppose we could have predicted is he was really fixated on all the individual details of the drawings, which kind of underscores the fact that you can't really listen to the CD while you're reading the book because. He, you know, kids, I think, generally want to stay on a page for a long time and look at each individual thing.
You guys have really carved out an amazing place for yourself in the music business. You keep making a living, even though you're right. coming very much from the independent side, which tends to devour right. bands after a while.
We've dug quite a beautiful pit for ourselves.
You've dug a beautiful hole for yourselves. What do you think is the reason you've been able to continue to do pretty much what you want?
I think that a lot of bands just give up because they have this idea of where they're supposed to be. And we really didn't ever form a concept of what this kind of band was supposed to be doing or what level of commercial success was requisite.
But there was also a moment early in your careers when you guys really hit and you were charting on very much on the grown-up charts. And then as so often happens, things got a little tougher, but you stuck with it. What kept
well, it
you
was
going?
A, it was a long haul before we made any kind of inroads into I mean we were a local band in New York for 4 years and that was you know that's a pretty thankless task and so we were pretty by the time we had any kind of commercial success, we were already pretty we had pretty diminished expectations. I think the main thing is we actually enjoy what we do in the sort of immediate moment of it. You know, we actually were really proud of the songs we do and we are lucky in that a lot of bands like us have a kind of success where a song ends up kind of following them around in as like this sort of dark cloud, like they hate their own success. I mean we see that so much in other bands when we do festivals. Bands going like, we're not going to play that song. You know, right. We never had that problem.
Well, since you brought your instruments, and we're very happy about that, let's hear another song from Bed, 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 but live.
Okay. This song is called Idlewild.
La, 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 la. Shines bright on a hot summer day. Roller coasters away. See the sideshow at Steeplechase Park. Test your strength, guess your way.
When you guys write a song for kids as opposed to grown-ups, a lot of your music is very whimsical. Is there a different head you bring to it, though, when you're writing for children?
Well, it's what's an interesting challenge for us is to try and approach the children's stuff in the same way. In other words, to make it as interesting to us and as entertaining and have as much going on, in a sense, but without... you know, writing stuff that doesn't make sense to kids or isn't interesting for kids. I think that we, you know, realized we were pretty well suited for that job, oddly, that we could cook up material that we really liked that was appropriate for kids.
Did you ever expect to be as versatile as you are? I mean, you started out as an indie rock band and now
right.
you've done music for pretty big time TV shows and commercials, including Pepsi-Cola.
I mean, a lot of times people early on would say, you know, you guys could do anything you want. It's so glad you're not using your music for the forces of evil. and I'm, you know, I'm not sure if we've gone over to the dark side or not by like doing the work for hire stuff. It's just on a musical level, the great thing about doing outside stuff is you can kind of stretch out. We can do a lot of instrumental stuff. We've done a lot of different kinds of work in the outside world.
And, of course, you continue to write songs for grown-ups. And
yes.
we're very pleased that you've got a bit of a new one that you're going to play for us
That's
the
right.
first time anywhere.
Yeah, this is a shorty. John, you want to introduce the song?
Yep. This is a shorty. It's called Stalk of Wheat. I went for a walk
on a stalk,
on a stalk of weed, and it felt like a trillion feet. I was looking for a friend
at the end,
at the end of the line, and it took me till the end of time. I was all out of luck,
like a duck
that died. I was all out of juice,
like a goose,
like a moose denied. I was all out of money, like a bunny that's broke. I was all out of work, like a jerk who's a joke. And I was out of ideas, like I is, like I is, like I is, like I is. I was out
of ideas, of ideas.
I once had a dream
of
a gleam in my eye, and I'll have it till the day I die. I had a thought bubble
of
trouble and strife, and I'll have it for the rest of my life. I was all out of luck,
like
a duck that died. I was all out of juice, like a moose denied. I was all out of money, like a bunny that's broke. I was all out of work, like a jerk who's a joke. And I was out of ideas, like I is, like I is, like I is, like I is. I was out
of ideas, of ideas, of ideas, of ideas.
It's called
Stalk of Wheat.
Guys, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
John Flansburg and John Linnell are They Might Be Giants. Their new album and book are called Bed, Bed, Bed. And guys, why don't you take us out on something?
Yeah, this is a song from the book. It's called Impossible.
Well, they said I was impossible. Yes, they said I was impossible. And that someone who behaved like me couldn't be. But I knew that I was possible, not completely unbelievable. And the one they said could never be, it was me, it was me. But there's some.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now.
Out of nothing into something new. Something made up into something true. Though it happens quite impossibly, the impossible turns out to be possibly.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
A journalist tells the story of a young man's suicide, the young man, her 12-year-old son.
And we talk with Marianne Pearl, the widow of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.